Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Grammy Award winner Andrew York. Andrew was a member of the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet for 16 years. His most recent solo release was a double LP, which earned him a top spot on Acoustic Guitar Magazine's Essential Recordings of 2012. Tonight we talk about classical guitar, compositions, and even his jazz influences. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We got a great show for you tonight. Scott, how are you doing?
I am doing fine. I've been busy, actually, messing around with a bunch of different pedals and pedal orders, actually, what I've been kind of messing around with. I've been testing that out and been editing some videos, but having some fun putting a distortion in front and behind a wah, messing with a little boost pedal from Custom Audio Electronics that I've been messing around with, trying that, mm-hmm. See how that affects things, and it's pretty cool. I'm just kind of having some fun just mixing around the pedal order.
Any new videos coming? Or did you release anything this week?
I didn't release anything this week, but I should have something hopefully by the end of the week. So,
any sneak preview of what it's going to
be? Well, it'll be what I was talking about before. It's the Audio-Technica headphones, and then hopefully I should have something maybe with Canon Geyser, which would be appropriate to the show.
Okay, well, that'll be appropriate. Okay, well, listen, let's get right to it. I'm going to go ahead and go to our commercial spot, and we'll come right back. This is going to be a great show. I've known Andy for a long time, but anyway, we'll be right back, and we'll get right to it.
Hi, this is Aaron Raby, your resident guitars and amps geek at Sweetwater Sound. 1-800-222-4700 or catch us on the web at www.sweetwater.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the Flow.
Hi, this is Elliot Easton of the Empty Hearts, and you're listening to Scott and Jeff on the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts.
We are back. When I'm going to start out first, I'm going to read something that was on one of Andy's albums that kind of really resonated with me. I think it's a very important, and it's been one of my little pet peeves when I was in school. you know, the fact that I'll read it for you, but basically there's a, you know, for music to for any type of art form to exist and thrive, you need new blood, you need new things coming in. And when I was in school in the classical department at USC at the time, you know, there was a very restricted repertoire that you could play or practice and whatever. Everybody was doing the kind of the same things. And this guy, our guest tonight, Andy, and also some of the other people like James Smith, they were actively trying to create new music and new transcriptions to basically expand the repertoire for classical guitar. And I think that's just, to me, that's a big thing. But anyway, this is a quote from one of Andy's albums, the Hauser Sessions, where he was using Andre Segovia's guitar for the whole album. But here I quote, Andre Segovia is responsible for the entire world of classical guitar as we know it today, from university degree programs to worldwide concerts of classical guitar music. Segovia also made it his life's mission to create a repertoire for the instrument, and this he did by transcribing masterworks of the past, such as works by J.S. Bach, but also by working directly with the composers to create a living modern body of works for guitar. Following Segovia's life work, Julian Bream is especially noted for increasing the guitar repertoire by commissioning many 20th century composers to write for the instrument. Any art that is static is dead. Some in the guitar world are resistant to bringing contemporary influences into the repertoire. This protection of what is seen as the good of the past is understandable, but it produces a peculiar tension with artists who always strive to create something new. Without new material that reflects the culture of the day, an art form will wither away. Imagine telling Mozart that he should write in the style of 100 years before his time, or not at all. Undoubtedly, many did tell him this, a poignant analog to those who disparage new musical directions today. Fortunately, Mozart did not listen to them and moved music far forward with his brilliance. My goal is the same as Segovia's. On his guitar, I am playing new music just as he did in his day. Like him, I understand that is vital to push the musical envelope in new and unusual directions. Truly, I can't imagine doing anything else. And that pretty much, in my opinion, defines Andrew York. Andy, it's great to have you on the show tonight.
Thanks, Jeff and Scott. Pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm going to play a clip. When I met Andy, it was quite a while ago. It was way before he was with the LA Guitar Quartet. And I also want to thank on the air our mutual friend, Jeff Muller, the dentist of all guitarists. Yes, our dentist. He's another guitar player and a very good classical player. But he took me down to the Fret House. And this piece was one of the first things I heard about. And I was really impressed with the fact that you were playing, besides the classical guitar, you had steel string guitar. And I think you even brought an electric guitar there. And you tried three different things. And I always thought that you should always do different things. I remember I got in trouble in school. I was playing some little Bach things that were exercises. And I used to play them on my 12 string. It just sounded really cool. And when I told my teacher, he hit the ceiling. But anyway, it was, you know, to me, I was really impressed with the fact that you could comfortably move around with the different instruments of, you know, and make it work cohesively. So I'm going to play this. It's probably one of your more famous ones. It's called Sunburst. And this one I picked from the original album, Perfect Sky, your first album. It's the steel string version. He has another version on one of the later albums. I think it's Yamour that has the, you have it on you do it on classical guitar.
Actually on Into Dark, but yeah.
Into Dark. So anyway, let me play this and you get an idea, this clip of it, and then we'll talk about that. Thank you. So that was one of the first things I heard, and that's on steel string guitar, but still within the same, you know, the same style, though he's doing some things that actually work well for steel string. But anyway, thanks again. First of all, welcome to the show, obviously.
Yeah.
But what I want to ask you right now, the obvious question, is the transition from steel string to nylon string and into electric guitar. How do you approach that? Obviously, there is a difference, but I mean, can you explain how you adapt? Is there like an adaptive process of the different styles? Or, you know, because there was a song on your called Darkest Dreaming on Y'amour, and you chose, in your notes, you say specifically, I chose steel string guitar because of the timbre of the instrument best suited the piece.
The sustain, it needs that sustain, so I had to do that piece. Mm-hmm. That's a steel string piece. Yeah.
Now, how do you deal with like your nails and?
Well, first, let me answer that you said about the adaptive process. For me, there was no adapting because I played steel string when I was a boy, starting at six mm-hmm. years old. And then I was a rock and roll player in my early teens and was playing in bars by the time I was like 15 and 16. So it's not so much adapting as they were both classical, steel, and electric were all natural languages for me. They're very different instruments. But just like a sax player that picks up a flute, you know, in a big band, it's not so much an adaptation, but they're just literally playing different instruments. So you go into that mode. So for me, playing electric is just completely different than playing classical, everything about it. So it was less adapting than just getting into the electric mode, which is a completely different way of playing, touching, sustaining, approaching, writing, everything. So I see them actually more as different instruments than the same instruments. Even steel and nylon I see as very different instruments.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, like, for example, when I was in school, classical, the fundamental position for classical is your hand is basically 90 degrees to the strings with your thumb, and you pull up.
Not anymore.
It's changed. I remember when I was playing banjo, you had to put your hand on the bridge and play. And I used to get in trouble all the time for doing that.
Well, the right angle thing, that was kind of a French thing. Was it LaGoya? But nobody does that anymore, or very few, because that's the thinnest possible sound you can get. It's you're attacking the string with essentially the minimum contact of a plane, whereas now we play at an angle which crosses the string at, instead of straight across, it goes across at an angle, making more contact, and it brings out a lot more of the fundamental and lower partials. Yeah.
So you're hitting it, he's demonstrating with his hand again, and it's like about a 45-degree angle?
Approximately. And I personally, because I'm so into tone and changing tone, that I vary the angle continuously. I don't play with a static hand position. Now, there are players now, even today, who never change tone, they never move their hand, and they never change their angle. They believe guitar should have one sound, the sound of the guitar. I'm completely in the other camp. The one thing guitar can do that no other instrument can do, and I'm speaking of classical guitars now, is they can change tone dramatically. Mm-hmm. You can't do that with other instruments. Of course, you can't do it with piano, can't do it with violin, can't do it with cello. Not really. I mean, you can make very subtle changes in tone, but guitar, you can make extremely dramatic and beautiful changes in tone. That's what I love.
What was the reason for having the hand position the other way? Like, why?
That's a good question. I don't know, because the LaGoya technique actually was really unnatural. You had to turn your hand to the right, which is just a recipe for hand problems. You know, you cock your hand to the right and then try and move your hands. You can just feel all the tendons straining in the wrist. So now it's all about being natural. You know, everything, the hand, the joints, being in the most natural position you can do. Guitar is hard enough. We don't want to put the body in a really awkward or funny position.
Yeah, no, that's true. And because back in the day, I remember that the main way you changed your tone was where you were picking, whether you went closer to the bridge or you went closer to the fretboard.
That's right, and it still is. But, you know, the funny thing is, as I'm getting older, I really have different perspectives on this. That is the most brute force way of changing tone. You would go from tasto near the sound near the neck to ponticello near the bridge, which means by the bridge, and that's a very brittle and dry sound. And even that is a continuum. You know, there's not just you can be in the middle, or you can be Ponticello, or you can be Tosto. It's like this whole continuum that you can actually move while you play. But beyond, I said that was sort of a brute force approach to tone, because now, even without moving my arm, I can stay in one position, and just by changing the angle, like we talked about, I can change my tone dramatically without even moving. I've had people come up to me after a concert, and they say, you don't even move your hand, but the sound changes continuously. It's just flowing, this tone that's moving. Not many people really do that, but this is sort of what I've made. I didn't do it as artifice. I do it as it's a natural expression. This is the way I want the music to sound.
Can you give us an example? Can you just demo a little bit, a couple of notes, and show us how you're doing it, where you're in one position and you're actually changing?
Sure. So I'll just stay right here. It's just balanced normal, and then I haven't moved.
He hasn't moved his hands at all.
And now I'm going to bring it warm. And that's without moving. That's all I did is go to the position you mentioned first. That's that very straight. See, that's the very straight.
That was 90 the
degrees.
Old
goal.
Yeah.
And that's just as bright as you can get. It's okay. It's a great sound for what it is. But see, as I angle, it gets warmer and warmer until it's absolutely dark. When I first studied with James Smith, he said, wow, you have a dark sound. At that time, I liked everything to be quite dark. I liked the beauty of it, the really warmth. And I thought about that a lot, because he really noticed that you have a dark sound. And now I still do have a dark sound, but not always. I change it a lot. And then, so this, now I can add in like the lateral movement. So now there's Ponticello, the old style, but I'll make a warm Ponticello by changing the angle. So I'm doing Ponticello, but plucking warm. Now I'll do Ponticello and pluck. Now I'll go Tosto. And here's a bright Tosto. Sorry, hard to do a talk.
That's pretty dramatic.
And then a warm Tosto.
Now, do you ever change, like, for example, you'll play darker on the outer strings and the inner voices?
Absolutely. Well, this is another thing. It's such a huge subject. To me, everything is contrapuntal. I only think in voices now. I don't think in verticality so much. I think in linear ways. So, for example, here I was doing the thumb with only flesh. So,
right.
So, and it sounds like a bass player. Now I'll do it with nail. This is the way most classical players would play it. Just a bright nail, but see. Now I'll do a soft nail with a apoyando or a rest stroke, or I can go back to flesh. So every finger, I mean, especially the thumb, because the thumb's doing the bass lines usually, I'll play often very different technique with the thumb. Half the time flesh, half the time nail, but almost always apoyando.
So by going to angle, you get more flesh. You're adding more meat to
it. Yeah, it's just the flesh, you know, because it's the nail is a sharp ridge that's, you know, you're going to excite the string in a very different way, whereas the flesh basically damps out a lot of the high frequencies and gives you this boom, this, you know, much more fundamental. It's a very beautiful sound.
Yeah, and I noticed on your recordings that those inner voices really ring true. It's real clear.
This is everything. I mean, this is the older I get, the more important it is to play in a three-dimensional way and bring out all the inner voices with integrity and tone, you know, great tone, so they sound consistent.
I'm going to play another. Well, let's take a listen to something that I think kind of shows that. It's from Into Dark. And you can hear the clarity in what he's doing. It's called the Chilean Dance. This is a little clip. It's kind of cool. It's very up, and it's just, I mean, my hands ache thinking about trying to play it. But here, take a listen. Thank you. So I think you can hear all the inner voices. Everything that you're doing in there is just crystal clear. Now, let's get a little into gear here. What guitar were you using there? That was from Into Dark.
Yeah, that was a guitar made by Eric Saline.
Mm-hmm. And that was that what you were using when I saw you in the Fret House?
It must have been, yeah, probably so. I played Saline guitars for quite a while.
Okay, and in one of your albums called The Hauser Sessions, you actually played Segovia's Hauser.
It was a guitar that Segovia had. We know this because it was signed on the inside. You could only see it with a mirror. If you slid a mirror in the sound hole, Hauser himself signed it to Segovia in French. So, you know, something like, "To my dear friend Andre Segovia." So nobody even knew it was in there until somebody looked. So we know that Segovia had it in his possession. We don't know if he used it in concert much because he had a number of Hausers, but definitely it was one he had in his hands.
And how did you get the opportunity to play it?
Well, a friend of mine bought it. Actually, that guitar had an amazing history. I mean, just since my friend bought it, like, I don't know, say 12 years ago or something, as briefly as possible, he bought it, left it in the trunk of his car. A ring of car thieves where he used to park would make copies of keys, and then they would follow you, and when you stopped your car and went into a building, they'd steal your car because they actually had a key they'd made. So they stole his car, had the Hauser in the trunk. They opened it up somewhere, thought, "We don't want this thing," and they threw the guitar, case and all, into some bushes. A kid walking home from school found it. This girl found it, walked home with it, had it for several years, and then decided she wanted lessons. You know, she was playing with a pick and everything. They didn't know what it was. So she went with her father to a guitar shop, and the guy there knew, you know, he looked at this, and he's like, "Wait a minute. Where did you get this?" So the guitar reappeared, you know, on the scene, and my friend ended up getting it back. So I actually did the recording after all that. The guitar was lost to history for maybe 5 years. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then reemerged. I know.
That's amazing how it just went all the way around.
Yeah, a guitar has a story to tell.
Yeah. But now, how did that guitar compare to what you were using before? That's an interesting, because I mean, I remember Duke Miller at USC. He had one. But what was your feeling? How would you compare it to your Saline or any of the other guitars you played?
It wasn't a guitar I could ever play in concert. It was extremely quiet, and it had some deficits. But what it had something so sweet that when I played it, there was just a sweetness to it that I just didn't want to put it down. You know, and then I had the idea, it would be great to make a recording. And I did, not intending to make a CD. I just wanted to track with it because it was such a cool guitar and a cool part of history. And it had a sweetness. Turns out in the record, I mean, to be honest, it falls short on some of the more aggressive passages where I would need a more modern guitar. Now, perhaps it was just this Hauser, I don't know, but what it had in sweetness just was gold. It was golden. But what it lacked was sort of the ability to handle my more aggressive nature.
Well, let's play. Okay, I have a mellow clip from there, and that's the one that you wrote for Jeff Muller, so I got to play it. This is called Sketch for Jeff, and it's part of your Suite 7 in Essence.
Right, they're student pieces, yeah. A book of student pieces.
Okay, here we go. Now, that was you just were flagging me when we were playing. That's what I had pulled off of the CD, but that isn't Sketch for Jeff.
Mea culpa. That's called Transitions. I actually, on one pressing of the CD, I have the songs in the wrong order for that suite. So that's actually called transitions. Sorry, Jeff. I know you're sitting there going, wait a minute.
Wait, that's not
the piece he wrote for me. Yeah.
But you can hear, I mean, it's a nice warms. It's a nice.
Oh, yeah. It's a
nice
beautiful
sound,
little guitar.
Really sound.
Just love that guitar. Yeah.
I mean, Duke was just, he loved his. That was a big deal for, he really liked that guitar. It was one of his prizes.
No doubt, yeah.
Now, the. Also, too, I want to ask you real quick. I'm going to play one of the pieces that you did. It's from the first album. It's actually the title song, Perfect Sky. You were using the Celine guitar. What steel string do you use?
That is one my dad gave me. It's a 1957 Martin D28.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's it? Just kidding.
Yeah. I still have it.
What electric guitar did you use? I remember you brought
a Gibson ES-175D.
Oh, okay.
Well, so you're gonna play Perfect Sky? That's actually an electric piece. That's the
right,
that's
right.
Okay.
Just I want to kind of show the different how you naturally go from one. I mean, those are these guitars are different guitars, but
as you said
at the beginning, you know, you were playing electric guitar and steel string guitar since you were way younger. So there isn't any transition. You just go right to it. But I want to, again, it's interesting because the inner voices, your finger style. It all ties together, but it works, and it's just another color, and still the piece stands for itself. But here, let me play it. That's the 175.
Great. Yeah.
That's a great sound. Now, what I was going to ask you, and also, too, let's talk about one other interesting guitar that you played, an 1888 Torres. And if you go to Andy's site, andrewyork.net, there's a video of you playing this guitar. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, that was a guitar that went through Guitar Salon International in Santa Monica. A friend of mine owns that, Tim McClouchy, in the place, and he just gets incredible amounts of vintage guitars. So that one went through his place of business there. And they do videos and they ask me, you want to come in and play this guitar? It had already been sold for just an exorbitant amount. So I said, yeah, I'd love to play that guitar. Now, here's the thing. That guitar was, I think it was 1888, if I remember right. And it played like it was built a year ago. It was so solid. It was just like a rock in a good way. You know, everything was just completely balanced, and you know, it just, there was nothing wrong with it. I couldn't believe this guitar. That was a rocking guitar, and these are smaller. Back then, guitars were noticeably smaller than they are now.
It looked like you playing it looked like almost like a parlor guitar. It was like really small.
Well, they were. That was the standard size back then. I'm not sure of the scale length, but yeah, I actually love those guitars. There's a sound to them that is just, I like them even better in a way than modern guitars. But yeah, this guitar was just a gem. If I was, you know, incredibly wealthy, I would like to buy it.
And that
unfortunately, musicians can't buy guitars like that, only collectors.
Was that Taurus, was it made for a Torrega or something?
It was at the same, essentially, I forget. Now, Torrega had a guitar that was made a year or two before or after the one he played all the time. So this one I don't believe was Torrega's, but it was from the exact period when Torrega got his that he played forever.
Now, I was asking you when we were listening to one of the pieces about the bracing on classical guitars, and how is that different compared to what we're used to on standard acoustic steel strings?
Right. Well, you know, steel strings, of course, having much more tension, probably have a more robust bracing. But most nylons having lower tension, they actually, Torres himself is the father of guitar construction. Almost all guitars that are considered traditional have what we call Torres bracings. Bracing. And now there's also lots of experiments. I have a number of guitars. I have one by Matthias Dahmann, which is a double top. He's this brilliant German luthier, and he makes the loudest guitars I've ever heard. He really figured out how to use the minimal energy and spend it wisely without killing the sustain or tone, and the guitars are noticeably louder than anything else. And he does it with like a honeycomb bracing in between two paper-thin pieces of cedar. Then I also have a lattice brace Celine. In fact, the one you heard me on first, Jeff, was a lattice brace Celine, to like a honeycomb underneath the top of a wood.
Interesting. Now, so there's not like a fan bracing behind the bridge that you know of? Or
I guess it is. All the traditional ones are more of a fan bracing, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't really, I'm not a luthier, so I don't really know the ins and outs, the technical details. But yeah, I think the Torres bracing, if I'm not wrong, is a fan bracing.
And then usually the wood combination is a cedar with some sort of rosewood most of the time.
Yeah, most of my guitars are cedar with Brazilian rosewood back and sides. I also have some spruces, various kinds, but I tend to be more comfortable with cedar, though I love spruce too. It's a different voice, you know.
Yeah, I think the steel string, there's a cross brace that near where the bridge is to help reinforce it so it doesn't pull up. I think that's one of the main differences. And then Martin did this X-type bracing and A-type bracing that was their unique way of it, but it reinforced the spruce top so that, because the tension is just greater. Now, when you play live, you just mic yourself, right? Have you ever experienced, because I know in the early days with like piezo pickups, they don't sound that great, but there's a lot of new stuff out, like LR Bags and Fishman. They have microphones inside the body and in a contact under. Have you ever tried that?
Sure, I've tried a lot of them. I have one of my David Daly guitars, which is what I've been playing now for a long time. The guitar is by David Daly. He's out of Sparks, Nevada. He outfitted me one with the... It is a piezo pickup, which you're right, they sound like crap no matter what you do. But this kind of piezo has three pickups pointing in X, Y, and Z axes. So the theory is, because they point it in each direction, it picks up the movement of the top in three dimensions instead of just the one coming straight down from the saddle, which is really crude. So it did sound a lot more natural. You still had to shape it because it had that crispy, crunchy high end that piezos can't help but make. But yeah, so I had that.
You don't use a mic in there? You don't have a
mic? I did not. I would mic it in front, and then I would blend in certain amounts of the pickup. I'm doing a tour in a month with some steel string guys with the International Guitar Night. So we're doing like this 6-week tour, and these guys play loud. They're steel string players. So I'm going to figure something else out. I don't want to use my old electric. I'm going to use something new, something I can fly with and not worry about it getting destroyed too, because I need to, you know, hit a lot of cities, and I need something I can plug in to compete with these steel string guys, because they're going to be quite noisy. You know, I was going to say, yeah, the real sad state of affairs is that there is no good pickup system for classical. Partly it's because the nature of the instrument. Steel string, with all its tension and this huge amount of frequencies, right? It's got metal, so it's just ringing with all these harmonics. It's a lot to choose from. And so you have a lot to work with the pickup system, and the great tension means you got a lot of sustain, even if you saddle it up with, you know, extra mass like a pickup. Nylon, you can't do it. There's so little energy involved because nylon is not nearly the tension of metal, and we have very little high frequency content, so it's really delicate, and to pick it up accurately is just almost impossible. That's why piezo sounds so bad on nylon string, is because we have almost no high frequencies anyway, really, and what there is just destroyed by the piezo. And what kills me is that a lot of people in the pop world think a nylon string guitar sound like what they hear on pop, you know, in pop music, which is just this awful, bright, nasty, honky sound.
Yeah, they tend to brighten it anyway just to cut through.
What a sad state of affairs, because really, nylon string is one of the most beautiful sounds I can imagine. It's just so warm and lovely, but you almost never hear that in the pop world, which is almost everybody's world. You know, it's just, it's a technological thing. It's just a problem.
I wonder what Willie Nelson uses on his guitar.
Well, he has a Martin. That's interesting, too, because now you're seeing companies like Taylor making hybrid classicals, or I call hybrid, because they're using more of a slender neck of a steel string. It's not the traditional classical neck, but it's a full, you know, and some of them are pretty interesting. I mean, Willie Nelson has his own sound, but that guitar is actually a pretty mellow guitar. And I played Martin classicals before, older ones, and they're actually kind of sweet sounding. They're not bad. You know, it's not traditional. When I was in school, everybody wanted a Ramirez. That was the
right,
thing
that was
of town.
At the time.
Well, his isn't traditional because it has two holes.
Well, he's strummed right through the sound.
One's getting bigger all the time.
Yeah. No, and
he has termites in that thing.
Speaking about different instruments and stuff, I was looking at your bio. I didn't realize that you were part of the U.S. Early Music Ensemble. Now, did you ever try using other types of strings besides the nylon? Because there were, you could get gut strings.
You know, I would love to. I've never done it. Actually, somebody gave me a set, and I've not yet put them on. I mean, they're supposed to be really problematic. They don't stay in tune. They break easy and all these things. But if when they worked, it was a great sound. I mean, an example is that one of my favorite cellists. He's a Baroque cellist named Honor Bilsma, and he plays on a Baroque cello with gut strings. And when you hear a recording, you're like, whoa. Because modern cello has steel strings. You hear these gut strings, it's just like, it's another world. It's like really a different sound. That's the way it all sounded back then.
Right.
Even
some of the early piano, they didn't have steel strings back then.
Huh.
You know, the early, I think Baroque piano was a lot softer sounding. That's how they made the strings.
Right.
But in the early ensemble, did you play lute?
I did. In fact, that's how I met Scott Tennant. We essentially played the same lute part because we both needed credit in the ensemble. So the director just said, all right, both of you play the part. And they were really like rock and roll virtuosic. It was called Morley Consort back in the day. And the lute players were the rock stars. So there were lines, I'm not kidding you, like, he's just going. And, you know, we would do this in unison. It was really it was fun.
How did you like playing the lute compared to what's the difference from guitar?
A lute, I mean, it's like an uncle or something of the guitar in the sense that it's really, you know, it has frets and it has a neck, but it sounds so different. It's a very quiet instrument from a quieter time, and it has no bridge, you know, I mean, or no saddle. The strings just come straight out of the bridge, so really it has very little sustain. And the sustain is also eaten up by the gut frets. The frets are gut. So it's real plunky like a banjo, not in a bad way. I mean, the notes are actually really short. That being said, it's just a delightful sound. In the hands of someone who plays with traditional lute technique, it's a great thing because the way they used to play it, they play at this different hand position that brought out the best tone. Like the worst sound of a lute is to play with classical technique, which I did because I wasn't comfortable with the old technique because you have to tear your nails off, you have to cut them off, and I wasn't going to do it. But I love those guys like Paul Odette, the, you know, great lutenist that plays the old style, and he brings out this beautiful sound. You can't get
the original. Authentic lute playing was no nails.
No nails, and your thumb was on the inside of your hand instead of on the outside. Like, well, what I mean is, with classical, your thumb's to the left of your index finger on your right hand. With lute, it's to the right
That's
of
like
your
banjo.
Index finger.
That's how a lot of the banjo players
play.
Yeah,
and it's way down like this, and
your
way
hand's
you kind
of turned around,
Yeah, it just brings out a great sound.
Yeah. No, but, well, you were always kind of pushing sounds out of the guitar. You guys always, especially with the LA Guitar Quartet, you guys got some really interesting things you guys were doing. Counterpuntal things, but also different sounds. What got you, I mean, you, for a per, I mean, I think you, you won a, your Grammy was for Guitar Heroes. Mm-hmm. You did some interesting stuff in there, but can you talk about how you developed all this? Because you did some interesting technique.
Well, yeah, when I got in the group, it was still relatively conservative in a sense. You know, they'd studied with the Romeros, and they were finding their own voice. And as when I joined, we began this exploration. We were four Americans, and we were realizing that we couldn't be the Romeros. We weren't Spanish. We are what we are, and we all had backgrounds in varying degrees in other styles. Me the most of all, because with my jazz and rock background and everything. But you know, Scott had played lute. He studied flamenco. John had studied flamenco and did like this Chet Atkins stuff. Bill played rock a bit when he was, you know, young. And so we had this. So we realized to be authentic, we have to actually be American guitarists. Well, that means we had to find ways to make the guitar quartet a lot more than a classical guitar.
Me, that opened my ears. Like, you know, I have to admit, I was experimenting more for myself on electric guitar and even steel string, but mostly, you know, you were getting tones out of a pedal or something like that. And I, you know, classical guitar was a classical guitar. I used it for a certain sound. And even in a studio contest as a studio player, you brought it in for a certain type of sound. But then I'm hearing like, wow, you guys are, I never heard a classical guitar sound like that.
We pushed the envelope and it has changed the technique.
Yes.
You know, and I'm still doing it as a soloist. You know, I play the guitar, even though I play with classical technique, I play in a manner that I don't hear many other people playing, because mm-hmm. I want more out of the guitar than what has been historically acceptable.
Well, I think that's, I mean, to me, that's part of that vitality of bringing in the new blood, the new repertoire, the new style. I think that, and the other thing that you guys did, which especially with Guitar Heroes, which I was so glad it won the Grammy, is because you took, you know, you took your favorite pieces, a lot of it from, some of them were from rock influences, and made it into your own piece, and it won the Grammy for that. So it kind of crossed everything over, where people were like, you know, nobody would really think of doing a with classical guitar or something from Hendrix or something like that.
Yeah.
So what I want to do is play a clip from one of your solo albums. This is again from Into Dark, which a lot of the, you really pushed the gambit there. And this is Marley's Ghost. Can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I love reggae, and I used to listen to a lot of Bob Marley. Reggae is such a just a wonderful, refreshing, you know, style. I love it.
You can never be sad with reggae.
That's right. So I wanted to write a reggae classical guitar piece. So this is what
I did. Here's a clip of it. This is Marley's Ghost. First time I've ever heard reggae classical. It's just killer. Now, you also, again, you pushed the, again, your album Centerpiece. You played some pretty diverse instrumentalists on that. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I'm going to play the Centerpiece
yeah.
with Andy Summers.
Well, you know, when I left the quartet, that was a long time coming and very amicable parting. And mainly, I just needed to leave for artistic reasons. I wanted to do other things. I have a background in improvisation and composition and other styles. And I felt like I wasn't getting to express those. And it was bothering me. So the first thing I did when I left the group, actually the second, I did a record for Sony Japan first. But this one is half free improvisation with a great pianist named Alaudin Matthew. And then there's some classical piano pieces that I wrote that I played with a Japanese pianist named Mitsuko Kado. And then there's one piece with Andy Summers. We spent 2 days in the studio just playing all these different tracks, or all these different instruments, and tracking a piece called Centerpiece. I later did Centerpiece as a solo version on my next record, Yumour, which I've been touring a lot. So it's, most people know it now as the solo version. But yeah, this is the one with Andy Summers.
When you were doing the Andy Summers, though, before I play it, was he improvising on top of it? I know, I understand that your solo version of it, it's structured, right? Or do you still...
I recomposed it to make a solo version out of it using the same ideas. But yeah, we did some improvisation on it. Andy did some improvising, and we worked kind of in 2 days. We kind of put it together. I had written almost all the sections, and we would figure out like what it needed, and we'd try things out and add, you know, bass. Andy would add some distorted electric guitar. We just sort of... It was really creative and really fun.
Okay. And I want everybody to listen to it at the very end of the piece. Andy's doing these real lush chords, or like on the lower end of, in this little section. It's just a small section of the whole. It's a really, you got to listen to the whole thing to really do it justice. But listen to this, because part of that technique that he was talking about, the way he changes tone, it just gets this like real rich, this real rich low end type of chordal thing that's really cool. But anyway, take a listen. Was that the Celine?
No, those were all David Daly guitars. Actually, I played a lot of different guitars. I don't remember. I used some of Andy's. He had an Ober that we were using some. We would kind of trade off. He used the Ober more. I was using mainly, I think, my David Daly's. I used a couple of them there.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, that last little part, man, those chords are just so rich. I mean, that's to die for sound.
I think I was playing some steel string, too. I don't even remember what. I think one of Andy's, yeah. And he was playing a couple different electrics and...
And it just, and the little like percussion, and then of course the low piano. Yeah. Note. I love it. It's just great.
Yeah, I haven't heard that in a long time.
But anyway, and now one other thing. We're almost towards the end of the show, and this was another thing that impressed me when I first met you. Is when we were over at the Fret House, when it was time for you to, you took a slight intermission, so we went over to the table and you had your CDs there, but he had his sheet music there. And I haven't found too many of the, a lot of people just don't publish sheet music, which I thought was really cool, because you could get the pieces that you were playing and learn them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and if you go on his, on your site, you can buy sheet music for a lot of the different pieces.
Pretty much all of them. You can do them by instant download now, too.
Yeah, you have like a little app or program that you have that you can run that. So you were always aware of that. I mean, that was to me, that's really important, because that, again, you know, for other players to take it and start playing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a classical tradition. I mean, from, you know, all composers want their music to be out there. I mean, I consider myself a serious composer, you know, and you want your music to be published, because that's the way it's disseminated, not so much from recordings, but from the printed page, which is how other musicians would learn it.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I just don't see too many other artists doing that. I was blown away, because Jeff Muller, he's a big collector of transcriptions and pieces, and he bought all the scores and he keeps everything. And it was like, I was pretty impressed, because that is cool. So you could actually take the piece and make it your own. Yeah. It was really kind of cool.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we're already out of time and we just barely touched the surface. I just want everybody to go over to www.andrewyork.net and you can catch all this stuff. There's a complete disc. You can get MP3s. His stuff's on Amazon. The albums I was playing here was his first one, Perfect Sky, Into Dark, which has got a lot of different things. Centerpiece is the one where he has what you heard with Andy Summers. The Hauser Sessions is really good. And his newest one, Yamour, or his latest one, and I didn't even get to play. There's like several pieces I didn't even get the chance to play. But anyway, I want to thank you, Andy. It's really a pleasure, and we definitely have to have you back on.
Thank you, Scott.
Yes.
And where are you headed off to now? You just came back from Brazil, right?
No, I was in Europe, actually.
Europe.
I did a Northern European tour.
And where are you off to now? You're home for the holidays and then out?
Yeah, then out again to U.S. and Canadian tour with the International Guitar Night.
Oh, okay. And anything coming up? Another album? Are we going to see another?
Not yet. I got to write some more music now.
Yeah. Okay, then we're going to tell us a little bit about this piece you're going to leave us with.
So this is the title cut of my last record, Yamour. It's in a funny tuning. It's D, A, D, F sharp, B, D, which I'm really enjoying. There's sounds you can get in this tuning you can't get in others. So this is Yamour. Thank you.
Thank you.